Good morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're taking you today to Melbourne, near where we used to live, actually.
And we're still in Australia. Those boys were there a long time, huh?
Yeah. We have a lineup of some of our most favorite chefs today, and also some special chef personalities that happen to be in Melbourne for the well-traditioned Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. First off, we're going to be at
Donovan's House. Donovan's House on the beach in St. Kilda, which is the place in Australia, perhaps the Western in the whole world, where we've always been made to feel the most welcome. And we met both of the owners, Gail and Kevin Donovan. And, of course, ladies first, so Gail Donovan's up next.
Ann and Peter have been coming to Donovan's for a number of years, 8, I think, by my last calculation. And we're meeting with a dear friend, as well as the owner, co-owner of the restaurant, Donovan's, in St. Kilda, in Melbourne. And For those, Gail, who don't know the restaurant as well as we, let's just step back and talk about the concept of this restaurant, where you are, what you serve, and why it's so special. I know that, but there are people who've never been, and you're wonderful.
It's a pretty simple concept. It's what we call, what people call the total picture, is what I think it is. The building that we're in, we're so lovely to have the lease on this building, was an old bathing box built in about the 1920s. We turned it into a restaurant now 10 years ago. Here's cheers to our 10th birthday. It's a rare building because it sits right on the sand. So although everybody thinks that Australia is a country surrounded by water, which it is, there are very few restaurants on the beach. So we're lucky to have it. And when we started, my concept was that it looks like, the building looks like an old house. It really does. So we said to ourselves, and it's still our concept today, that we would make it look like a house inside, which it does, make it really comfortable, and we would serve the food that we love to eat. And we call it Donovan's, which is our surname, because we said that it'll be our family business. And here we are 10 years later.
And it's you and your husband.
Absolutely. And 69 staff.
69? You've grown. Now it's a gorgeous setting. It's just, I'm looking right out over the water now, and I've always been very happy here. Talk to us about, it always amazed me that you changed the decor with the seasons. You so personalized this place. It is like being welcomed into a home.
The only thing we don't do here is live here, but we live close by, but we love it. And we, look, when we first bought the building, it was a summer business and not a winter business. There was no winter business here at all. So we put in fireplaces in the hope that we could make the business comfortable. And that's what came about the change. We had all these typical sort of striped, lovable, laughing fabrics for summer. And we decided that we made the decision that we would change all the fabrics and all the decor, for winter and make it really warm and comfortable. And that, touch wood, has kept us just as busy in winter as we are in summer. So in the 10 years we've been open, for those people that are in business, we've never advertised, but we have changed the decor every 6 months. So people say to me, I'm really lucky because I can keep shopping my whole life. So the minute I finish one change, I start working on the next one, which means that this change has got, this is about shells. There's shells everywhere and big bold stripes. So there's usually in my mind some sort of theme. We change the uniforms for the staff. And not only is it great for our customers, but everybody gets into it. What are we doing for the next change? What's coming? So it keeps it fresh for our customers, and it keeps it fresh for us.
And what kind of food do you serve?
The best. Well, we said the concept of the menu is still exactly the same as it was in the beginning. It's quite a large menu. We filled it up with things that we love to eat ourselves. And we also said, a big ask, but we said we would like the restaurant to be something for everybody, in that you could come and have a quick pasta and a glass of wine, or you could come and have an intense, luscious menu and drink your way through the 600-odd wines that are on the list. And it wouldn't have barriers for the elderly, the young, the corporate, the rich, the poor, and it hasn't. It's worked out to be all things for everybody. And so those classic dishes that we started with are still there.
10 years later. Now, Peter, you wanted a comment.
I went to check in the bar, because every time we've been here, there's been a different kind of decoration. This time, listeners, it's Gail will tell us how many Pernod bottles side by side above the bar. There was another time we came, it was that red Campari thing, and then another time, I think before that, it was beer. And I'm sure it's been a number of things in between. But how many bottles are there in the display?
124. And in the baskets in the front where you can see the champagne, there's 15 dozen bottles of champagne in there. They're all real.
Now, you also have, you've been around long enough, you have some really interesting observations about the Melbourne dining scene in general.
The Melbourne dining scene in general is flourishing incredibly, right? People... We adore to eat out here, and we adore to eat out in every facet that there is, from the high-end market to the low-end beautiful market, and you will have seen all of the beautiful ethnic restaurants that we have and how original and wonderful they are. The problem that Melbourne's had now is that it's actually outgrown its resources. So the only thing that we have any problem with this business is we're trying to find, like all of our friends in the same business, we don't have enough trained people to run the businesses. Waiters and cooks. It might take you 6 months to find a waiter or a cook that's got enough experience to work in your business. And that's our one real challenge at the moment.
Any listeners who are qualified, contact Gail Donovan.
Head on over. We're really lucky in that out of the 69 staff that we have, more than 70% of them have been with us for 5 years or more. So that is a great thing. And we have 11 staff that are on long service leave, which means they've been with us for 10 years or more. But it's the next lot below, where that's the summer kids that are students and whatever, that we need as casual staff, that are really, really difficult to find. And we're all in the same boat. We're all having the same problem. And we would have a waiter here that, we would think might not be ready for a senior waiter, that'll be offered a position somewhere else as a manager. So that's just how short of staff we are.
Now, there's a great sense of community that has developed. When we first were in Geelong and in Melbourne, there was not this community, this restaurant community, chefs, staff, and there is one now.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, completely. Look, our neighbours that are around here that have restaurants, we would do anything to help each other. We're all in this together. We don't have yes, we compete, but perfect. So you should. That makes us good. That makes you try harder. I think that's a wonderful thing. But we have a great camaraderie and a great respect for each other. We would not steal staff from anybody else. No, no way. And so that's kind of like an unwritten law. We would never give a false reference. If somebody's leaving that has a problem, we pass on the information. The person that's employing them needs to take it for what it is. So I think we're honest with each other, and we need to be. It's what I call Melbourne is a big country town. So we need to look after each other.
Now, where are you with the books?
Books. Okay. Well, we still have our first beautiful book, Salute, is still selling. Now, we owe our publishers another book, but we kind of haven't got there yet. We've been a little bit lazy. So, what do we say? It's on the stove cooking, but it's not ready to eat yet.
Tell the story of where we saw the letter from you in Sicily.
In Kankivecchia? Oh, it's a really interesting thing. It's the people that we met in Sicily and the people that we stayed with when we wrote the first book actually became friends, and we're still in contact with them all. And it's no surprise that you would go there and find a letter from us on their wall. It's no surprise, because I hope that they loved us as much as we loved them.
Well, we were really startled. But anyhow, we're going to be talking later to specifics on the menu with your husband, right? We love seeing you again, Gail.
It's great to see you. Anytime you want to come, I'll be here.
Okay.
So it's 400 people on the beach tomorrow in celebration of the 10th anniversary. Listeners, the answer about Donovan's is when you get the email address. Because it's eat@donovanshouse.com. I mean, is there anything you'd like to add to that, or does that say it all?
No, that says all. That's exactly what it is. And what I said to you, people say, oh, you know, 10 years is a long time. Look, if ever was a day where we got up and we didn't want to come to this beautiful place, we wouldn't be here. We'd sell it. But we love it. We honour it. It's been great to us. We love our kids that work for us. Why would we not do it? We absolutely adore it. It's never an effort to be here.
We'll wait now and talk about the food and eat as well. We always eat too much here.
And now we'll hear from husband and co-partner, K. Kevin Donovan.
Curiously enough, we had never met Kevin before, although he's always been in the background, so it was lovely to meet him in person. And there's a photograph of handsome Kevin and beautiful Anne on our website as well, if you care to take a look at that.
Kevin Donovan, we've never interviewed you, and turns out you're American.
Yes, born and raised in Connecticut, arrived in Australia in 1986, working for Hyatt Hotels, never really intending to stay, but 3 years later, in 89, had an opportunity, and that's the rest is history.
You have an interesting background. You started out how?
In hotel management, University of Massachusetts, then a career with Hyatt Hotels around the states, Cambridge, Dallas, Dearborn, Michigan, then breaking service and studying cooking with Madeleine Kamen for her first program in Annecy in France.
And we said that she was a tough taskmaster.
She was, but she's a brilliant, brilliant tactician. And in ingredients-based, we would go to the market every morning and learning about different things. And she's a wonderful, wonderful cook.
Now, you said something I found interesting about the difference between the focus of hotel management and the focus, and we're talking about food, of course, in a private restaurant.
Yes, in a hotel, it's certainly when I was coming up, and this is in the late 70s, early 80s, food was more theater than real ingredients-based. Sourcing the wonderful produce and handling it simply and doing all that, those sorts of things. Where we, in the hotels, we had to put bells and whistles on everything. In the function areas, in the restaurants, and that was really food and beverage in hotels in the early 80s. It was just about vision and appearance.
Now, they're going back to all this tableside presentation and flambéing to the ceiling.
Yes, we did. We did a lot of that. Sunday brunch always had a flambé dish, and a Sunday buffet brunch at the Hyatt Regency in Cambridge was a massive affair, serving 600 to 700 people every Sunday, and people would be lining up with holding their Boston Globe and waiting and drinking Bloody Marys, and it was what people did on a Sunday. I'm not sure if in the States they still do that.
I think they do. You moved from there to Europe, and then Europe. How did you get to Australia?
Well, I got to Australia via Singapore, actually. After studying with Madeleine, I cooked with Jimmy Schmidt at the London Chop House back sort of 82, 83. And then I was contacted by Hyatt to come back in the fold, so to speak, take up the position of Assistant Food and Beverage Manager at the Hyatt Regency in Singapore. Obviously, quite an interesting posting, which I was keen to do. And there I went from 83 to 86 as Assistant F&B, and I had my big shot when I came to Melbourne to open the Hyatt on Collins as Director of Food and Beverage, now called the Grand Hyatt, of course.
Yeah, actually, we've stayed there. And then you met Gail?
I actually hired Gail back in, she became the, banquet sales manager for the Hyatt. Wonderful function space at that hotel. And we worked together for 3 years. And then I decided I was going to leave Hyatt and open my own restaurant. And, of course, Gail was not with me every day any longer. And therefore, and many believe that the romance was ongoing, but it actually didn't start until after I left the hotel.
So you had to marry her to get her.
Well, yes. Yes. We lived together for several years. We had a restaurant in South Yarra, another suburb of Melbourne, where we did an east-west fusion restaurant called Chinois, an obvious copy of Wolfgang Puck's restaurant in Santa Monica, but our version, an Australian version. And until we had the opportunity to take this restaurant over in January 95.
And it's just an absolutely incredible location, which we already talked about. And Gail said how lucky you are to be here, and I'm sure you feel the same way.
Oh, yeah. It's you couldn't find a better position for a restaurant. We're sitting virtually on the sand on Port Phillip Bay. And while the restaurant is our peak season, it's still wonderful in winter with the fires going inside the restaurant and the lovely fireplaces. And the weather, the rain can be hitting the building horizontally, and you're warm and comfy inside here in the depths of winter in June, July, in our winter.
Now, you do some wine things here as well as food, right?
We do a lot of wine things. The wine list started 10 years ago with probably about 120 selections, 120 references of virtually only Australian wine. And obviously, the subject of wine internationally has exploded. And the interest in the topic has gained unbelievable momentum. So now our wine list has grown to nearly 600 selections, including white wine, red, white and red wines of the old world, the traditional winemaking countries, of course, and certainly from the new world with an obvious slant towards Australia and certainly and New Zealand.
Now, I want to ask you about this menu, because Gail said if you really want to listen to Passion, ask him about the food. Where to start? Tell us, like, she said that basically the menu is what you guys like to eat. But tell us a little bit more and give us some highlight dishes.
When we opened, we wanted to create a menu that was difficult to order from because there were many things that you would like to have. Often, how many times do we go to a restaurant? We have five appetizers, five main courses, and five desserts. That's all we get to choose from. Our menu has probably 60 items, probably even more, closer to 70 items. And there are probably 15 different appetizers, 15 different main courses. And some of the dishes have been on the menu since we started because they're so signature-oriented. We do a lovely baby, lovely little tiny calamari squid dish stuffed with... parsley and lemon juice, lightly dusted with flour, and then pan-fried.
May I eat that, please?
Yes, you may eat that. You may eat that. We wanted to have a pasta section on the menu, and therefore we make our own ravioli. We use exceptional dried pasta from Italy, linguine and spaghetti, because we feel that we can't make it any better than they make.
Who do you use, by the way?
The rusticella.
That's our favorite, absolute favorite pasta maker. Oh, we've been to the factory. We love the whole guy. Anyhow, okay, move on.
Risotto with the famous Ferron arborio rice. You can't find better than that. So pasta has a great feature on the menu. We wanted a barbecue, and therefore we're grilling steaks and fish. Over Mallee root charcoal, which is an indigenous timber to Australia, and red gum. And you get a wonderful, if you have our T-bone steak, massive 500-gram or 1-pound T-bone steak, it's cooked over the charcoals, it's just wonderful. The flavor is exceptional. Whole baby snapper, which is a local fish, one of our local fish, similar to dorade in Europe. I'm not sure what you would have similar to that in America.
Well, you know, this is true. I mean, you are passionate about this food, and
we really love it. And our chef Robert Castellani was born in Italy. He spent 7 years with Stephanie Alexander, who is the mother of cooking in Australia. And the wonderful braising techniques and all the ingredients focused things that we try to do, it's just part of his being, and we sit and talk about food every day.
Well, listeners, we keep coming back, and if you haven't been, you need to start coming. And it's St Kilda's outside of Melbourne, and it's just. It's absolutely the most fabulous place, lots of hospitality as well as great food. And Kevin, I'm glad we got to talk to you this time. We usually talk to Gail only, but I love Gail and I'm happy to talk to you too.
Well, it's interesting that, a couple can live together and work together, and have the relationship, flourish. But as Gail is fond of saying, we look at things differently. She pays attention to things that I don't pay attention to, and vice versa. Gail is responsible for the way the restaurant looks. I'm responsible for the way the restaurant runs. So therefore, we have different roles. Yet, we start talking about it at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we're still talking about it at 11 o'clock at night. And we do this 7 days a week. And then when we travel, it's like a busman's holiday, because we're doing looking at food. Turning plates over to see what sort of crockery is on the table, and assessing the crystal, and assessing the silverware, and how's the wine list laid out, and what's the menu like, and what's the interior like, and what are the draw cards. So we're involved with food and wine on a daily basis.
As we are too, as you well know, listeners, please try to fit Donovan's into your hectic schedule. I would say I would make a specific trip, even just to sample it.
Wonderful. We'd love to welcome anybody and anybody at the restaurant, come and say hello.
Well, I could sit there and stare out at that wonderful beach parade, all the sand, the ocean, the glorious sky forever, but now it's time that we take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to email us your thoughts at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Well, you know, it seems, Rabbit, that this is Old Friends Week because we have a long history, not only with the Donovans, but also with our next guest, Philippe Michel.
Who is widely rated among people around Australia as one of Australia's best chefs, probably the best exponent of modified French cuisine for Australian ingredients.
And a decent, wonderful human being.
And we had the chance to catch up with him at a restaurant venture, which for him is about 3 years old, in the Crown Casino Complex on the south side of the Yarra River in Melbourne.
Bonjour. We are now we're having a reunion of sorts with a dear old, not old chronologically, but we've known for a long time. We were at the Brasserie by Philippe Michel in Melbourne, and it's been a long time since we've seen you, and a long time since we first met you. Hello. Bonjour, Philippe.
Bonjour. Yeah, it's been a long time, I think, maybe 6-7 years, maybe more.
In 2000, we were at Bocuse.
2000, yes. Yes, we opened Paul Bocuse in 2000. Yes, I remember, yes.
Now, you've been around. You are France-born in Normandy.
That's correct, yeah, the country of good cream, good seafood, and of course, good Calvados.
Love Calvados. And you've cooked in Asia?
I cook in Asia. First, Mr. Bocuse sent me in Tokyo, where I spent 15 years in Tokyo. I spent 4 years in Hong Kong as well. So, yeah, a few years, we can say that, a few years in Asia, yes.
Now, when we first met you at the restaurant Bocuse, you were cooking Bocuse's food with Asian twists.
Exactly, yes. The recipes were mostly, not the recipe, the influence was Paul Bocuse. You know, I worked 25 years for Paul Bocuse, so it's like having a stamp of Paul Bocuse. Yeah, you cannot forget the man like that. So I have a big influence on Paul Bocuse, but because, like he always said to me, say, the success of the chef abroad is to use the local produce, which I did, and to make sure you please the customer, to give them what they want. So even having an influence with Paul Bocuse, I was still trying to use a small twist, trying to use some spices or some Asian influence.
And your presentations have always been gorgeous. You know, the one thing I always think about Paul Bocuse is his truffle souffle that I burn my mouth on every time.
Yeah, the truffle soup is, of course, is a classic of Paul Bocuse. You really have to be careful when you eat it because it's very, very hot, yes.
No, it was soup, not the souffle. I just had a crust. Because you break the crust. And after, that was a long time ago, you moved on to the place where we saw you last in Melbourne, which was?
That was Langton's. We opened Langton, and I stayed 4 years in Langton. And then from there, I moved again 2 years in Tokyo. I don't know if you remember, but my wife is Japanese, so she wanted to go back to see her family. So we stayed 2 years in Tokyo. And then I decided to come back and open the brasserie in Melbourne again.
Now, I'm looking around, and your decor and the ambience is so French. Could you describe a little bit what your concept of this brasserie is? And by the way, how does the brasserie differ from a bistro?
Okay, the brasserie, I will call my brasserie a brasserie gastronomique. It's between a fine dining room. It's not quite a fine dining room. It's between a fine dining room and a bistro. A bistro will be very casual, no tablecloths, for an example, no tablecloths on the table, and the food will be inexpensive, The service will be casual as well, still professional. And a brasserie will be a step better, maybe. We will have, like we have at the brasserie in Melbourne, some tablecloths. The service will be a little bit more attention in the service. And the food also will be, even without being too expensive, like a fine dining room. But the produce will be carefully chosen. And we still be using some offal as well, like kidney. We will do a cassoulet, maybe. We will do bouillabaisse and choucroute. But it's not quite yet a fine dining room.
And there's no Asian. This is pure French. No Asian influence in this, except you said you'd like to keep it light.
I keep it light. My Asian influence at the brasserie maybe will be keep it all the dishes light, free of too much cream. Actually, we don't use any cream in our cooking, except in our pastry, of course. And the sauce will be more like jus, reduced jus. So this is a French brasserie, but with a contemporary touch, I will say.
Now, I'm looking, you have a blackboard with your specials. Just mention for our listeners some of the specials for today.
Okay, our special, like this, this week we have some maroon. They're not maroon like chestnut. They are maroon are the crustacean.
We call them Mikey.
Okay, Mikey, and they're from the one we have are from Kangaroo Island, which in South Australia. But they're clear water crustacean, so a little bit sweet.
They're blue.
They can be blue. They can be red. A bit of two or three colors. Yes, and green as well, actually. So that's one of the speciality. What else do we have? A pork belly, which is a confit or pork belly. When I say confit, I say confit because it's cooked for 18 hours, very slowly in the oven, so it doesn't dry out. What else do we have? We've got the maroon. We've got the okshik. Okshik is, it's very popular actually now in, around the world. And I think I was the first one to introduce okshik in Melbourne when I was at Paul Bocuse. Even if it's not a fine dining room ingredient, we used to cook okshik and beef tenderloin. And I think I was the first one to introduce okshik. And now okshik, I mean, everyone is cooking okshik.
Our favorite, we had in Spain, we had pig's trotter stuffed with okshik, didn't we?
Yeah, it's a fantastic a piece of meat when you cook it very, very slowly. We cook our okshik for 24 hours in the oven. It's a slow cooking, and it's fantastic. And this one is even better because it's Wagyu okshik.
Oh, wow. Now, we have also your menu here, and you do have some really classic dishes. You have escargot. You have, what do you have? Oh, you have all kinds of shellfish, of course, oysters. I mean, everything looks so good. It's a bigger menu than I anticipated, though.
Yes, it's quite a big menu. Maybe some people will say too big, but I like to work with what's available on the season, what's available in the country, and you know, I like the customer to have the choice as well, and I think they've got a lot of choice. There is, like you said, there is shellfish, there is fish, there is meat, there is beef, there is lamb, there is duck, there is chicken, there is everything. Like a bit like a brasserie in France, you will have different cut of meat, different meat, different fish, shellfish. So it's a little bit of everything, yes.
Well, everything you make is good. I mean, why else have we followed you through all these restaurants all these years? Listeners, absolutely put this on your Melbourne map. Where exactly are we, and what is your website?
Yeah, the website is www.thebrasserie@philippemouchel.com.au, and we are located in the Crown Casino in Melbourne, and the address is 8 Whiteman Street, South Bank. Very easy to find.
And Peter wants a word.
Well, there's another tip for you, listeners, because last evening we had dinner at an excellent restaurant where the chef was a pupil of Chef Philippe Mouchel. So I think it would be a smart thing to do if you're dining in Melbourne, or even if you're dining perhaps in Sydney, to ask, did you ever work for Philippe Mouchel? Because if you do, I think that will be a stamp of approval. I'm guessing that makes you feel pretty good, Philippe.
I'm very proud of it. I'm sure you're mentioning Anthony Ross from the Landgraf Hotel. Anthony used to work for me at Paul Bocuse. I've got a few chefs around the city and even out of the city working who used to work for me and who are doing very, very well.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your contribution. And that's the deal, listeners. If it's somebody's been through Philippe Michel's kitchen, you can be sure it's good.
And with that, I think it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And
Who would it be? Who would it be on the menu other than Ann and Peter Haig?
Exactly. After a while.
after a while, it gets sort of repetitive. But,
it does.
Talking about landmarks in modern Australian cuisine, absolutely one of the founding fathers, although he certainly doesn't seem old enough to be, is Neil Perry, original restaurant in Sydney called Rockpool, now changing his formula somewhat, and we caught up with him at Rockpool Bar and Grill in Melbourne, a concept that he's going to be moving back to Sydney, and we talk about all that in an extensive interview that's coming next. I'm sure you'll find it fascinating.
Neil Perry is called the father of modern Australian cuisine. Neil, you don't look old enough to have fathered an entire era.
Well, I've got quite a few children, but I'm not sure about an era of Australian cooking. But I am 50, so I've been around for a very long time in the period, I guess, of where Australian food has really changed.
I just decided, how many children do you have?
Oh, I've got three.
Well, that's not. We interviewed a chef who had four boys. That's a lot. Okay, you brought up the subject is what was, let's call pre and post Neil Perry. What was Australian cuisine like before you hit the scene?
Well, I think there were a number of good cooks, but I think that Australians' preoccupation with food was minimal compared to what it is today. The quality of the produce was not as good. The variety was not as good. And a lot of chefs like myself over the last 30 years have really worked with growers and fishermen to increase the quality of the ingredient. And also people like myself and Chong Lu and, two or three of us really started to bring Asian flavours into Australian mainstream food, which had not really been done before. Philip Searle was another who did that. And I think together in the early 80s and through the 80s and early 90s, the three of us really pioneered that sort of light Asian flavouring and seasoning and cooking techniques that have now become much more mainstream cooking.
Of course, we were living here in the early 70s, and it was grim.
Yeah, in the 70s it was grim, but I mean, there's always been pockets of good food in Australia. My father was a brilliant cook and used to be a fisherman and a gardener, and he was a butcher, so we had awesome produce, and I think it was him that taught me a lot about that. But now, of course, you know, exponentially Australian food, the quality of Australian food has grown with many more immigrants coming to Australia. I mean, particularly the Asian immigrants that came after the Vietnam War and after the closure of the White Australia policy, and now a lot more Vietnamese and Thai and Chinese and Koreans and Japanese call Australia home. And, of course, they bring their produce with them, and a lot more Middle Eastern people. And so, like America, being a country born of immigration, we have a very multicultural cooking style.
Now, you had a series of restaurants, you cooked in a series of places, but your first really big, iconic restaurant was Rockpool in Sydney, which I have to tell you, we actually ate at 8 years ago.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's the restaurant that's probably defined my style. And that's where a lot of people say that if there is a kind of modern Australian cuisine, that's where, along with a few other restaurants, it was born, and a lot of people have been inspired by that. I just tend to think that I was cooking my food, very produce-focused. As I said before, a lot of Asian influence, but a lot of Mediterranean as well. But cooking my food, not imitating, not cooking other people's food, not cooking classical French or Italian or Thai or Chinese, but cooking a food that I really loved, inspired by all of those.
Now, I always associate you with fish, but you're in a transition phase where you've embraced both fish in the current incarnation of Rockpool Sydney, and also beef, where we are now in Rockpool Bar and Grill in Melbourne. Could you just talk a little bit about your concepts?
Well, I think the reason that at Rockpool I started working with fish very heavily was back in 89 when I opened Rockpool. I wasn't really that thrilled with a lot of the meat growers and a lot of the meat wholesalers, and I wasn't really happy with a lot of the game birds and things that we could get. Over a period of time since then, I've been able to build a great list of suppliers of people growing and rearing produce. But importantly, I've always wanted to open a steakhouse because my father was a butcher, my three brothers are butchers, so meat kind of runs in the family. And I've always harbored a desire to do it. And I understand a lot about meat from my family. And this was a great opportunity. I saw a brilliant site here, 200 seats, so it's a big restaurant. And to me, I just sort of straight away thought, well, this is my steakhouse. And having opened it, it's been brilliant, actually.
Describe where we are.
We're in Melbourne in what is called South Bank, I guess, in Crown Casino and Crown Towers, the hotel. There's a number of really great restaurants that are coming down here now. I've got Nobu next door and Guillaume, a French friend of mine from Sydney, is coming down. And also the two Italian boys who own Icebergs and North Bondi Italian are coming down and opening up a great restaurant, Rob and Morris, and they are terrific restaurateurs. So, yeah, and Philippe Michel. So we've really got a great little precinct of terrific restaurants that have got skilled cooks and really high-quality restaurateurs. So it's great. Lots of people are coming down.
Well, talking just before we started recording, I was so impressed with how much you know about meat, including the artificial insemination of various beets.
Sure. Well, it's really important to understand the mechanics of it, I suppose, and it starts with breeding program, and it starts with what they eat and where they're reared and what breed they are and how they fatten and how they're killed and how humanely they're killed and then how they're butchered and how they're aged and then finally how they're cooked. And that doesn't matter what you're talking about, whether you're talking about fish or you're talking about meat or vegetables. I mean, a paddock or a sea-to-plate approach is one that all great chefs or all good chefs take, because if you don't understand it from start to finish, it's very hard to deal with it and get the best out of it.
Now, you are aging how many pounds of prime beef on your property?
Well, we've got here 5,000 kilos, so what's that, nearly 10,000 pounds of beef. We usually like to get it on at about 35 days dry age, and we go up to about 45, 50 is about the longest we hold it. And we have a number of different cuts, and we also dry age Wagyu, which is really unusual. I buy whole bodies of Blackmore, which is the best purebred Wagyu in the country, or whole blood Wagyu in the country. So it's quite interesting when those 500 kilo bodies roll in every month. It's a sight to see.
You mean they roll in whole and you butcher them on the premises?
Well, they're actually in quarters. I wouldn't like to sort of chop their heads off, but they're interesting because they're such large carcasses to handle. You know, normal yearling beef in Australia would be a carcass weight of about 260 kilos, and these Wagyu come in between 450 and 500 kilos, so they're big animals.
Where do they grow them in Australia?
Our ones come from Victoria, so it's a local product for us. It's about they're actually bred about 40 minutes out of Melbourne, near Wantirna and State, and then they go up to finish their feedlotting is in the high country, up near the snowy mountains. So they actually are just beautifully looked after from the moment they're born. And we find with any kind of animal, no matter what we're dealing with, if we look at humanely reared, humanely slaughtered, well-treated animals, we end up getting better flavour, better taste, better texture. So very important.
I'm looking at this menu. Could you just skim through and mention to listeners the kinds of dishes that you're doing here?
Sure. Well, because of my love of seafood as well, it's the kind of steakhouse that does great fish as well, and I always find sometimes that steakhouses do good steak, and that's about it, whereas all the side dishes and all the pasta dishes are all handmade on the premises, and all the fish comes in. It's all line-caught. It's all beautifully handled, and importantly, it's actually dry filleted. So to come and have a sashimi of tuna or foretaste of the sea or some live scallops out of the tank that are shucked and served live, basically, they're moving still. If they had a heart, it would still be beating. And if you closed your eyes and tasted them, they're so sweet. You just wouldn't believe how amazing they are. Nutty, sweet, long length of flavor. They're one of the greatest things you can eat.
I might try those, although I had a hard time at a real classical sushi place where he wasn't kidding about live clam.
Oh, yeah. I'm not really that big on in Japan, they eat blood clam and love it. I'm not really a big fan of blood clam. I find it too tough.
And you've traveled a lot in the Far East.
Yeah, I mean, I've traveled a lot around the world. I've been very lucky. I've been working for 11 years now with Qantas, so I do a lot of travel to Europe, to the States, to Southeast Asia and Japan. So, yeah, I love anywhere where there's markets and good cooking and great restaurants.
Who are some of your chef buddies? I mean, I know who they are in Australia, but around the world, who are your buddies? Who do you hang with when you travel?
Guys like Heston Blumenthal in London and Thomas Keller and Tom Colicchio and Charlie Trotter. You know, these guys that I really like. Wolfgang and I had a chance to work together just recently, which was fun. We had a great time doing that. And what we find is that it's terrific to get together and actually, you know, we do fundraisers and different charity events. And it was great to go over to Charlie Trotter's place and do an event that for his academy that he runs to help raise funds for raising, you know, getting young people involved in the industry and young cooks after academies and the CIA and stuff. So, yeah, they're the sort of people that are really fun to hang out with.
Chefs love each other, I know that. So you're going to be, well, he does too. Peter wanted to ask a question.
Well, the first question I was going to ask, but you confirmed it, is that the Wagyu beef is indeed grown in Australia. And I think this is one of the first places in the world to do that, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. And David Blackmore is amazing with his genetics. And Thomas actually uses this Wagyu. And I keep saying to him, come down and try it when it's dry age rather than wet age. But, you know, I really believe, as Thomas does, and Heston has spoken to me about it as well, that we really think it is the best Wagyu that we've tasted outside of Japan. It really is incredibly fine textured, beautiful caramel, nutty popcorn flavour from the wonderful marbling, rather than sometimes you just get a greasy, fatty taste from particularly the F1s that are in Australia and the States that are heavily grain-fed. I don't think you really appreciate the flavour or taste of the meat.
Now, let's just go over all the concepts, because Rockpool Bar and Grill is relatively new in Melbourne. The original Rockpool's been changed over to Rockpool Fish. But Rockpool Bar and Grill is coming to Sydney. Is Rockpool Fish from Sydney coming to Melbourne? The key thing, I think, is there's probably a single website the listeners can go to find out. So, Neil, why don't you tell us what that is?
Well, I think the easiest one is to go to, and it's under construction or change now, but you'll get most of the idea of what we do, is just www.rockpool.com, and you'll then be faced with a number of options and you can go off and have a look at what we do. But, Rockpool has changed to Rockpool Fish. Sorry, Rockpool Fish, which has very much a seafood focus, and I moved away after the Olympics. We went to Set Menus, and I've moved away from that so that it's easier for me to deal with fishermen direct and get larger quantities of fish, which is what we do with our fishermen. And we deal directly with our beef growers here and our fishermen here. So I get fish from Victoria, Stricky Bay in South Australia, places like Clarence in New South Wales, stuff straight off Sydney, which is amazing. And, really nice group of fishermen working for us.
Now, it wouldn't be complete since we're in Australia, the land of some great wine secrets, if we didn't conclude by getting just a snippet from you about the wine program at your restaurants.
Well, at both restaurants, we try to be very Australian-focused, but also have an international representation. So, like many great restaurants around the world, we have representation from Italy and Spain and America, actually. We've probably got some of the best American wines on our list, both here and in Sydney. And we also, you know, focus very strongly on, you know, great regional experiences in Australia, which are like awesome Rieslings out of the Clare and brilliant Cabernets out of Margaret River and great Pinots out of Victoria and Tasmania, and Shiraz out of New South Wales, and of course brilliant Shiraz out of the Barossa and things of that nature. So fairly extensive. I mean, I think in Sydney we've got about 800 entries on the list, and here in Melbourne it's up to about 1,450 now. there's something for everybody.
Well, it's been a delight talking to you. You're as easy to talk to as your food is easy to eat. and listeners, you wouldn't have a complete Australian experience if you did not eat at one of Neil Perry's restaurants. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks very much. So I hope everyone enjoys if they do come to Australia.
We ate well in Australia. We also stayed at wonderful places, including this next place. Do you want to set that one up, Rabbit?
It's called the Langham Hotel. It's a new chain that's developing. They've been buying old properties. It actually used to be a Sheraton Hotel on the south bank of the Yarra River in a very excellent location. They've been putting a lot of work into the restaurant, and one of the things that they really put a great effort into is their name restaurant called Melba. And we interviewed the executive chef there, Anthony Ross, and here's what Anthony had to say to us.
On the menu is actually a bit overwhelmed. We just got a tour of this interactive restaurant at the Langham Hotel in Melbourne with executive chef Anthony Ross, and there's so much to eat and so much is beautiful that's displayed, so many options to do here, chef. I'm just totally overwhelmed. It's an amazing restaurant.
Thank you, Anne, and I'm glad that you enjoyed the sampling of our food here. We do pride ourselves with a lot of different variety and options and available for all the different guests who like to choose and pick from all over the world.
Let's jump back, Chef Anthony Ross. Give us a little bit of your background. You've hopscotched around a bit, haven't you?
I would think so, yes. I actually is trained in Hong Kong, and I work in a Popokus restaurant in Hong Kong. And after that, I came to Australia, and I work in Sydney, I work in Melbourne, and then I work in Tokyo Hilton as well. Then I came back, and I work for the opening for the Popokus restaurant again in Melbourne, and I work up in Queensland, and then I come back to Melbourne for the last 7 years.
And it turns out that your mentor is one of our most favorite chefs.
Coincidentally, that's correct. It's Philippe Michel is my mentor, and that's the style of food that I like to do is good, solid cooking taste and freshness and seasonal stuff.
Walk our listeners through your various stations.
First of all, when you come into our restaurant, you'll be see that the very catch your eyes is our tandoori station. In the station there, we actually showcase all those tandoori skill hanging on the rack there with, for example, tandoori chicken, tandoori prawns, lamb shish kebab, tandoori pork belly, and this is one of the things that our chef create. It's really unique in our restaurant.
And next up?
The next stop you will be passed by is our Italian pasta station, which beside the pasta, lovely pasta, we have different seafood in season, for example, the black mussels from Victoria, the prawns, calamari, and then past that, you will see our Turbo Wok Asian station there. In that station, the guests can have the option to choose and mix all the fresh ingredients that is available in Melbourne. For example, different kind of asparagus, different kind of mushrooms, pot noodles. And then they choose and give to the chefs and then cook in front of them in the very heated turbo wok. And they can see the flame flaming over. Past that is our rotisserie station. The rotisserie station that feature every day differently from tonight we have, as you can see, is the rack of lamb from Tasmania. We have sirloin steak, we have roast chicken, and different kind of roast rotisserie items.
And you have wonderful sides. You can you don't have actually made up salads. People can put together all the fresh local produce. The raw shellfish or the cooked shellfish would be absolutely spectacular. Swimmer crabs, and then of course everybody's going to gravitate to this absolutely mad dessert station. Tell us what that's about. I saw gummy bears.
Oh, well, the dessert station, I think, is really suitable from 3 years old up to 80 plus because, as you mentioned, the gummy bears is there, and also we have our famous chocolate fountain. We feature the Verona chocolate, and we have a different kind of ice cream sorbet, as well as that our in-house pastry chef every day create individual portions of sweet items like tiramisu, from creme brulee to all the little mousses, passion fruit cakes, everything. And we want to have so much selection that an individual portion. People can have rooms to come back for free, four serve, but all in small portion. That's the beauty of it.
And then, of course, there's also gorgeous local cheeses and everything that you need to go with it. The muscat raisins. I mean, just everything is so thought through, listeners, that it's amazing. It's not a typical buffet by any means.
That's right. And for our cheese board here, we actually want to not just showcase just any cheeses. We want our guests every night to come here to sample what is best can offer from Victoria, from overseas products. For example, Victoria, we have our Miroir Blue. We can also have Tasmanian, different kind of blue cheese, Rowing 40 Blues. As well as we also have our French products. We have different wash wine, Pont Levert, everything. So everybody can have something different for cheese connoisseur. They will love it.
And the hotel is really splendid. I'm looking now. Is there a website?
Yes, we do have a website. Our website is www.langhamhotels.com. And then please feel free to browse it, and you can see all different things that were happening in the hotel as well as our sister hotel.
And you're a delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and see you. Hope you enjoy your dinner tonight.
I expect I will.
This place was truly remarkable. I had more fun at that breakfast buffet. I had some mornings I would have Asian food. I would have miso soup, and some mornings I would have egg white only omelets, and they had exotic fruits. It was great. And then I had to spend a lot of time in the gym, which was also pretty wonderful. But I have to remark that I looked at the person next to me that looked like he was having a bad morning, and I thought, he looks familiar. And it turns out it was Rod Stewart. Well, after that little bit of excitement, I think it's time to take another sponsorship.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
For those just joining us, remember, please, that our email address is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
And we love to hear from you. And by the way, we usually say welcome back, so let's do that too.
Well, I've said welcome back how many times already?
Well, you always say welcome back. If you don't say welcome back, people think you're falling asleep.
Oh, dear. Well, anyhow, while in Melbourne, we really caught up with a group of celebrity chefs at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. I thought I had done it all until one of them presented us in one of the workshops with this. You'll find out about Fergus Henderson later on here. That we each had our own personal roasted pig's tail, and each table had a roasted half pig's head. And as I said to Peter, well, I did that once. I don't have to do that again.
Well, that's not our first interview. Yeah, it was an interesting lineup. All celebrities, all introduced themselves, so we'll just go from one to the other.
Michel Roux is a legend, but he's not daunting at all. He's probably the most congenial legend I've ever met. Welcome, Michel.
Yeah. Welcome, and thank you. I'm so happy to be with you today. Yes, I hope I'm not daunting. I'm not. That's the last thing I would love to be.
He's totally enchanting, and he is probably one of the best ambassadors for fine cooking that I've ever met. You are just always there. You mentor, you travel, you represent fine cooking. You've been cooking since you were 14.
Yes, I have. And indeed, now I love traveling more because my son, Alain, is looking after the Waterside Inn, which has been narrated three-star Michelin for 23 years unbroken. And the last 4 years have been, I left him totally in charge of the kitchen, the day-to-day, and the creation of new dishes. And he has kept the standard beautifully well, so that allowed me to be the ambassador of the Waterside around the world, and doing promotion and master classes and doing what I love to do, which is taking a bit of a time off, but seeing people around the world. Hospitality industry is a great industry, and it's lovely to meet other chefs from other parts of the world.
Chefs love meeting other chefs, I've noticed. Let's be a bit more specific. Your restaurant and your son, Alain, who, by the way, we've interviewed and is already on our audio archives for a wonderful interview. The Waterside Inn is in this peculiarly, I don't even know how to describe the village of Bray. It's all of a sudden center stage in food.
Well, Bray-on-Thames is a lovely little village, which is from 16th, 17th century. situated on the Thames Valley, not far away from Windsor Castle. And we've got a couple of top restaurants there, because we've got my friend Eston Blumenthal. He's doing molecular food, scientific food. And as I said on many occasions, it may not be my religion, but I respect what he's doing. I love his cooking from time to time, and he's a great young chef. So it's unique to have two three-star Michelin in one village. In fact, we are the most stars Michelin villages in Europe. In Europe.
In all of Europe. I knew it was in the UK.
Size of the village is so small, there is no other villages in Europe who do have two three-star.
Now, there's, of course, Heston also has that pub, the classic British pub. And there's somebody else is going to relocate, or is going to locate a restaurant there. Have you heard of that?
It's just happening now. There is an Italian restaurant which is opening. The guy is a charming man, very good cook. And he used to be one-star Michelin in Italy. So hopefully he will get a star or two. And that will boost the Bray village again even higher. So that's great news.
I have two questions. Let's see which one to do first. The first one was really whatever brought you all this way from Bray, outside of London, to Melbourne, Australia for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. And you partially answered that, but would you like to elaborate?
Well, the Wine and Food Festival is certainly a lot more than a festival. It's one of the best and greatest festivals in the world. I read about it. I saw a lot of documentation in the past. I've done some food and wine festival. I've been to Miami and a few others and partake into it. But Melbourne is the most beautiful city, which is got the best ingredient, certainly. If you go to the market, you very quickly realize the ingredients are superb. The most reliable restaurant as well, and chef. The chef are what I would call a real pro. They do every day a work which is a standard, which is even. So you don't have the up and down which can happen in some part of the world. And other city of Australia happened that way. So I've got a lot of respect and love towards Melbourne. Apart from the fact, of course, I mean, I met a young lady, Australian lady, 25 years ago in Sydney, but she was working in Melbourne. Robin, who is now my wife, and we're married. And therefore, I'm married to an Australian lady, and it gave me an incentive, not as I needed a lot, but to come to Melbourne and to be here in Australia. In fact, I'm going to Tasmania in a few days' time to spend a few days holiday, because I've never been, and because of all the beautiful produce they've got.
Now, I must say that there has to be something genetic about your culinary talent. There's you, your son Alain, your brother, your nephew.
Yes, and father was a very good chef, so was my grandfather as well. And my mother used to love cooking, and immediately after the war, which was the time I was born, there was very little product and money and around, and at home we were eating very simple food. But simple food can be simple if it is prepared with care and love and the heart is in it, then it is fantastic food. And she certainly was able to show me and brought me care and love towards food.
Could you just describe, I mean, every time we talk about great meals that we've ever had, we discuss our meal at Waterside Inn. Could you just describe for our listeners the kind of experience that you aim for but also deliver at Waterside Inn?
Well, it's true to say that we do have a team of people which make all the difference. I mean, there are 22 chefs in the kitchen, at least five of them been with me between 5 to 10 years. And it is absolutely led by example. It's like a university. Love and care is there at every minute, every moment. And we've got the best produce. The preparation of the food is one aspect. The execution is another one. And the skill and creativeness is superb. But you've got to look at the presentation as well. Presentation means really the food presented and served, the front of the house. The front of the house is unique. Diego Masiaga, who's been 22 years with me, he's a gem. You know, he's a gem. I mean, that guy make anyone happy.
Oh, we know him and love him.
Well, the way, you know, when we serve, when we send a duckling or a rib of beef and it's carved in front of the guests there and then, nobody can do it better than he does, and with a smile. And he fills up the dining room and makes everyone feeling unique and feeling special. And people just said, well, Sal, you know, the experience is unique because you've got the food is a 3-star, fair enough, and it's very good food, faultless. But the service is unique, and the surrounding on the river like that is magical. So what else do you want, you know? So it is, well, when I go away and I travel for a few weeks and I come back to the waterside, it's an eye opener, even for me.
I just can't imagine how you decided on Bray.
Well, I decided for the tree because the river, position. I love the tree, I love the river, and I love the village, which is 16th, 17th century villages. And that was the decision, really. And we've got 11 bedroom, which is wonderful, so people can... after dinner, they can tuck away in their little room there and have their breakfast cooked with fresh croissant, brioche, pain chocolat in the morning by a pâtissier who starts at 6 in the morning. So it's a little heaven. But Bray is a very special village, which I love.
Well, this has been a pleasure. You have a website, undoubtedly.
That is a problem. I've got a website, but I can't. It's on my car.
Oh, well, we will tell our listeners what it is, and waterside-in.co.uk. And listeners, this is a meal of a lifetime, and so is meeting you, Michel. Merci bien.
Thank you. I'm so happy to see you again, and look forward to see you at the waterside in the near future.
Right on. We're there.
It's amazing to go halfway across the world and meet a very well-known chef. Chef Fergus Henderson of a restaurant called St. John in London. And if you've been asleep recently, then you won't know that he's a proponent of what he calls nose-to-tail eating and a restaurant experience that goes along with that. And to tell you that he served today pig's tails and pig's heads gives you an idea that he does take this to the very extremes of the animal. But Fergus, welcome to On the Menu. Tell us about this thing called nose-to-tail on your restaurant, St. John in London.
Hello, welcome. It's nose-to-tail eating. It's common sense, really. And the restaurant, hopefully. Common sense hopefully runs through the whole kit and caboodle. It's knock the animal on the head. Impolite to not use it all. It also makes common sense to use it all. And the gastronomic possibilities that animal holds lie well, what lies beyond the fillet and the chop and the leg is joy and a treat.
Now, did you make that up, or did you learn it from somebody else? I mean, how did you strike up with this idea?
Well, there's no kind of cathartic moment where I went, it's, as I say, common, it's also the food I like, which if you're going to have a restaurant, surely it's the one place you can cook what you like. No one's going to argue with you. It wasn't a theory, it wasn't to change anyone's mind, we weren't going to start a movement in any way. But as it is, it seems to have had some slight effect. I lost my chain of thought.
Okay. During a cooking session today, you said pork fillet is all very well, but when it comes right down to it, it really doesn't taste all that good, and the other parts taste better.
Not that the fillet, actually, fillet doesn't taste that good. Not fillet, but I mean, if you look beyond the fillet, there's spleen, tripes, hearts, livers, kidneys, trotters, noses, tongues, tails, ears, cheeks. Which way would you go? So where's the excitement lying there?
It's funny, I don't know if you know Mario Batali, but in one of his cookbooks, he says it's wonderful that you can actually buy chicken and things like that in different pieces anymore, so that you can buy all thighs, which he thinks are much better. He says it saves you the trouble of giving the breast to the dogs, which is his way of describing. So he obviously doesn't like chicken breasts, and I think you're saying about the same thing.
Well, entirely. I think the chicken Kiev has a lot to answer for. It's out there and it's confused people. I mean, the meat and the bone, and having a bone to gnaw on is vital. I mean, kids are going to soon, when they end up, kids are going to go, what happened in that hole in the chicken? I mean, giblets are a thing of the past. And the chickens. Chickens are these strange hollow things. The kids wonder what happened inside there. It's a great shame. But I think people should remember the bone. Well, also, it's extraordinary how people flock to, I mean, everyone, there's definitely more talk about proper meat and rare breeds and good tasting meat. But still, the pink in plastic still rules in the supermarket. And definitely, I would say, is where people, most people buy their meat.
Now, one of the things that struck us when we saw where St. John Restaurant is that it's very close to the old Smithfield Market, which is now a wholesale-only market, but which used to be the essentially the butchery of London. Is there a coincidence to that, or did you put it there specifically for that reason?
More kind of a coincidence. The building's fantastic. It's a smokehouse, bacon smokehouse, so there's no coincidence it's next to the meat market. But also love the fact that pubs open at 6 in the morning. It's a very good thing, which allows a particular kind of life to take place there. All our meat comes from the farms directly. We know where our meat's, what it's been eating. Our piggies have been gambling. Our lambs, which mountains our lambs have been on. So we don't actually use the market that much. Even though we're very near it, it's not where our meat comes from.
I was just thinking the sighting, and you said exactly that, that there used to be a smokehouse, and it's there because it was right next to Smithfield, and that's the reason it was there. Now, there must be a website. Would you like to conclude just by making sure the listeners know how to find you when they come to London?
That's an interesting point. I checked my website. I haven't really got... Here we go. There's a website. It's www.stjohnrestaurant.com. That should find us. Unfortunately, I haven't really got a bit of a luggage when it comes to the internet. But www.stjohnrestaurant.com should find us.
And it's a place you should definitely go. The interesting thing is that this used to be a family partnership. So sitting on my right-hand side is Fergus Henderson. Sitting on my left is his wife and partner, Margot Henderson. Margot, you used to be at St. John, but now you're not. Tell us about what you're doing now.
I have a small canteen called Rochelle Canteen, and I run a catering business. And Fergus also forgot to say he has another restaurant called, with a website, which is www.stjohnbreadandwine.com, which has a fantastic bakery. Makes people Eccles cakes, and I buy all my bread from them and wonderful pastries. But my canteen is, my website is www.arnoldandhenderson. We also have a link on St. John's. But we're a catering company. We do large parties. We've traveled to Paris, cooked there in a big metal factory. We follow Fergus's philosophies, and we have a little canteen which is open Monday to Friday, just for lunch, and it's not licensed. So bring a bottle.
And Margot, where's that located? What part of London is that in?
It's in Shoreditch, in Arnold Circus, which is it's in a school, old Victorian school there, and it was the first council buildings which were ever built in Britain. And there with a bandstand in the middle, and you have to find a little doorbell which says canteen, and you press the doorbell and somebody says push the door, and then you'll come and find a very sweet little place.
And Shoreditch is one of those parts of London that people really should go to, correct? And the place where St. John is also a part of the city that we would strongly recommend that people should explore, because it's really interesting. Don't you agree?
Yeah, the east end is becoming much more, it's very exciting, lots of restaurants opening, bars. Brick Lane, which is just near where Bread and Wine is buzzing away. All sorts of exciting things are going on in that area. It's brilliant.
Yeah, there's a market in Brick Lane on Sunday. We never seem to be there on a Sunday in time to go, but I understand that's a very happening kind of thing.
It's packed on Sundays. Brick Lane is wild. There's markets all over, and Bread and Wine's just there. So it's all perfect.
And there's a fascinating statue on a corner not too far away from your restaurant, which is... it's wrong to say a tribute, but it's a memorial to the young man who kicked over the flame that caused the Great Fire of London. Am I right? It's sort of the so-and-so on Pudding Corner?
Pudding Lane. But I'm afraid that's where my history starts to get a bit wobbly. I don't know how close we are to that, actually. It's in the city, yes, but it's not far. You take it in on a historical stroll, no doubt.
My recollection is it's sort of across the corner from the old part of the Smithfield Market that used to be the retail market. But it was a landmark thing, and was it 1665, I forget, the Great Fire of London. And St. Paul's was built after that. A whole lot of this part of London was rebuilt after that. But it's a part of the city we would strongly recommend that you explore. Let's not forget then that when you go there, you go to St. John Restaurant, you go to St. John Bread and Wine, and you push the button for the canteen. And it's a great place to go.
It's a fantastic place to go for lunch Monday to Friday.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, Margot. A last thought for our listeners.
I highly recommend Rochelle Canteen for somewhere for lunch. Do take a bottle. Not good bottles. You can buy bread and wine from the bottle shop there. The family supporting each other there, I think.
So it's not only, it's called Keep It in the Family as well.
Yes.
And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. We had the opportunity to eat some of your My Last Supper. I have to admit that when I was hearing you speak, I was thinking about Richard Corrigan's stuffed pig's feet myself as the last meal I would have. But I was pretty close to the kinds of things you prefer, right?
Yes, no, I can see the sort of muskiness and stickiness of ricotta being a nice thing to go away with. Residue in your mouth to go face your maker.
Martin Picard, chef and restaurateur of Au Pied de Cochon in Montreal. Your cookbook caught my eye. It is unique. First of all, welcome.
Well, welcome. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm happy being here.
Yeah, how did you get to Melbourne, Australia, from Montreal, Canada?
How do I get by plane? That's not the question. You want to know how come I'm here? Yeah, it's probably because I become to be a well-known all over the world. And also, I'm in the My Last Supper book, and it's probably everything all together, you know.
Yeah, this is the theme. The whole Melbourne Food and Wine Festival has, as part of its theme, the Last Supper, which is a fabulous cookbook with celebrity chefs giving their last meal. What was yours?
Oh, I don't remember, but I know they had a truffle foie gras, Romani Conti, champagne, tuna, oyster, but I don't really know. But that was pretty simple, but with the best product.
Sounds like pretty good product. You must be in love with a pig because of your restaurant, the name of it, and some of your recipes.
Yeah, it's a good restaurant. You know, when you see cochon in Quebec, it's very convivial. And Au Pied de Cochon is a restaurant, you know, where they have no tablecloth and people are very casual. It's important for us to serve something convivial. So that's why it's like a brasserie a little bit, yeah.
You were born in Montreal, but then you spent early years in Morocco.
Yeah, after when I had 3 years old, we moved to Morocco for 3 years. So I came back at 6 years old.
At that young age, you don't have that much influence of Moroccan seasonings in your cooking, or do you?
Yeah, no, I believe they are, because, you know, I believe to 0 to 6 years old, it's very important formation time for a kid. And I saw a lot of, they have a lot of good taste in Morocco and a good gastronomy tradition. So, and I think it inspired me, you know, but it's an hypothesis.
Why did you fall in love with pig?
It's because you can cook it, you know, the nose to the tail. And if you're a good cook, you can do everything, and they have no lust at the end. And I like that idea. And you know, all the best thing that I had, you know, terrine of pork, which I don't, you know, you have to know, you have to be a good cook to work that animal. And and it's very tasty also.
Now your cookbook is just gorgeous and whimsical. You published this yourself, you said, but you had some really good friends doing excellent photographs, illustrations, wonderful humorous illustrations tell us about who the artists were working on this book with you.
They have Tom Tassel, who's illustrated everything. And also the other artist is Alex Brunel, who make the comic book, but it's only on the French version. And the other one is Jean-François Boilly, who wrote all the text and managed. He was there for everything. And also it's Marc Séguin, who lives now in Brooklyn. And he's a painter, and you know, at the beginning and the end of the book, you know, you can find his heart. Yeah.
Where exactly is your restaurant in Montreal?
If you go, it's the area is Le Plateau Mont-Royal. That's the name of the area, and it's on Duluth Street, 536 Duluth, and it's between Saint Denis and Saint Hubert Street.
And you have a website?
Yeah, I have a website. Yeah. we have a choice.
And so people can look up the restaurant on the website?
Yeah, they can. And they, also they can make a reservation, and they can have all the information they need to come visit us.
And it's called www.
Point au pied de cochon. Www. Restaurant au pied de cochon .com.
That's great. Some of the recipes are kind of wonderful. Like your, you have a pig's feet meatball.
Yeah, that's a traditional plate in Quebec. On we used to, and we still eat that plate for Christmas, and it's very very tasty. And it's very traditional and very simple, but it's a lot of our roots who are in that recipe.
Well, if anybody who wants to have stuffed pig stomach can go there, but other people can get some pretty basic things like flounder. There were some other articles here, salmon cakes. Yeah. You have seafood as well?
Yeah, it's when it's winter time, you know, we have a lot of meat. But when it's summer time, you know, we're doing maybe 80% of seafood and shell. So we have a beautiful seafood platters and a lot of fish and a lot of seafood, yeah.
Well, Martin, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I can't wait to come and visit your restaurant. And meanwhile, everybody, rush out and get this book, Au Pied de Cochon, because it's just gorgeous. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We're talking to Jonathan Waxman, who anytime anybody introduces him, it's almost like it's one word followed by an illustrious career as a chef. Could you explain a little bit about where you've been and why you're known by everybody?
Well, it's interesting. I actually started off as a musician. And I was a trombone player, and I played in pit bands in Las Vegas. I played in little rock and roll bands. And it wasn't until I was like 25 that I actually got bit by the culinary bug. And I was very lucky that I went to Tante Marie Cooking School in San Francisco with Mary Risley, who then encouraged me to go to La Verune in Paris. And that's how kind of the whole thing started.
Yeah, we just interviewed Anne Willen.
She, you know, she really did a remarkable thing. She made a school that was, you know, really for Americans and Canadians and, you know, English-speaking people, but they would get a French culinary education. She hired the best chefs. She had a great facility. She was very rigorous. And she ran it like a real school. And, you know, it was an amazing place to go, especially in the mid-70s, because France is going through its culinary revolution. You know, the Trois Gros and, you know, Roger Verger and Paul Bocuse and all, and Michel Gerard were all happening at that time. And, you know, I was very lucky to be able to go to those restaurants.
Sounds like you had a good time. Tell us a little bit more about your career from La Verne. Where did you go?
I was very lucky after La Verne. I was, I got a job with a Relais and Chateau restaurant, a little one-star restaurant in the Vosges region. And it was the chef, myself, and a dishwasher. And, you know, it was really great, and it was the hardest work I've ever done in my life. It was also the most rewarding. After that, I went Domaine Chandon opened up in Napa Valley, and I went to work there with Udo Nahutnis and Philippe Gentil, and I was there, and then I briefly went to Monterey for a small job, which I think I got fired from because I wasn't ready for it, and then I got a call from Alice Waters, who I had left a resume with a few months before, and she called me back and said, do you want to come work?
Stephanie Alexander and Alice Waters, or what they call Stephanie Alexander here, the Alice Waters of Australia. Do you know Stephanie?
I do not, I'm sorry.
Anyhow, so you were at Chez Panisse and when? Like, was it the heyday of the...
I was there right at the right time. I mean, it's interesting, Chez Panisse now is two restaurants, it's a cafe and upstairs and the restaurant downstairs. And when I was there, it was only one restaurant. And we served 120 people a day, and it was just Alice Waters, Jean-Pierre Moulet, and myself. And Lindsay Shear was a pastry chef. So it was a much different restaurant in those days. Judy Rogers was the luncheon chef. Deborah Madison was the prep cook. It was an amazing place.
What a galaxy of superstars. Your own restaurants. Let's talk about those.
Well, right now I have Barbudo in New York, which is my little Italian restaurant in a garage. And I started that restaurant because my partner, Fabrizio Ferri, who's a fashion photographer, has a studio above. And he had this space. He said, he really want to do an Italian restaurant with me. But I said, well, you know, I'm a California cook. I'm not really an Italian cook. He said, well, you kind of cook like my Roman mother. And I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, you really do. And he cajoled me in doing this restaurant, and it's turned out to be a great success. I also have West County Grill in Sebastopol, which is where I grew up in Sonoma County. When I grew up, it was all chicken farms, and that's what we had was a chicken farm. My grandparents raised chickens. My great uncles raised chickens, and they had apple orchards. And now it's a wonderful place. And I just opened a new place called Madeleine May in New York, which is kind of a sort of straightforward American restaurant.
I didn't know you would open it. Is that for West Side?
Yeah, 82nd in Columbus. It just opened up about 3 weeks ago.
Tell us a little bit about your philosophy of cooking.
Well, it's, in a word, simple. I think I'm, and also middle of the road. I like food that really portrays the flavors of the farm, the ranch, the sea, the air. And I think the least amount of fuss that I could, you know, intrude upon those ingredients, the better. But I do love the ability to grate. I think I'm a good saucier. I think I make beautiful plates. I think I like mixing up, crunchy and soft and fluffy and hard. And so I like different textures. Like I like putting breadcrumbs on pasta, for instance. Or I like, sort of sauteing gnocchi till they get crispy and fluffy. I like doing composed salads of mushrooms with macadamia nuts. Since I'm here in Australia, you know, I do a raw asparagus salad, just raw asparagus, olive oil, and salt and pepper, and Parmesan cheese. So I like sort of different styles of food, but very done simply.
Well, as somebody who eats for a living, I appreciate this. I'm grateful, as a matter of fact.
Now, we forgot to mention where we are. We said we're in an unusual place. So we're meeting St. Jonathan at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, 10,000 miles away from home. So how did you get here, Jonathan?
Well, it's interesting. There was a book published, photographed by a friend of mine named Melanie Dunay. It was called 50 Last Suppers. And it's an amazing book about chefs around the world describing their last meal. And she took these photographs to accompany their last meal sort of menu. And the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival used that book sort of as a focal point of part of the festival, and that's how I got here.
What was your last meal?
Well, my last meal was funny. It was guacamole and chips and margaritas.
Lots of margaritas.
and gnocchi. And it was lamb with truffles from the Rhone Valley. But the dessert was the best part. It was chocolate shortbread cookies with vanilla ice cream.
Yums. One more thing. You were mentioning about your vision for a new market in Manhattan.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I really respect farmers and people that are fishmongers. And there's no more real sort of meat purveyors and independent ones in Manhattan or fish people. And all these farmers need a venue. And within 200 miles of New York, there are fantastic farms. And they don't have a real access point. they sell things off where they are. Some of them are allowed to come into 14th Street to the Union Square Market. There's other small markets around the city. But if you analyze it, there are so many other farms that are dying to get their products into Manhattan. But they're hindered by two things. One is transportation, and two is just the time factor to get from the farm into the city, sell the stuff, and bring it back. So my idea was to try to create a true farmer's market, but more on the French model, or actually like in Melbourne, you know, have a meat portion, a fish portion, a cheese portion, and not have one cheese purveyor, have 10 cheese purveyors. Not have one person selling produce, but 50. And I think if we could find a peer to do that on, that would be a fantastic thing.
Well, we're going to try to squeeze into your session, which I understand is sold out. Is it today or tomorrow? But if not, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Well, that was a marathon, wasn't it?
It certainly was, and wasn't it fun? Oh, these people are just so fascinating.
There's some wonderful people, some generous hearted hospitality from old friends in Melbourne, some new friends that we met, and some personalities that I'm sure you enjoyed hearing from.
And it was a very, very well-run conference. I think that if anybody would want to plan ahead, they should start doing so.
And it'll be March 2009 will be the next time it happens.
Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Sometime just before the Melbourne Grand Prix is usually when it happens.
Yeah, and it's really, you want contact with, I mean, chefs come from all over to participate in this.
Absolutely all over the world. And if you want information, of course, you'll be able to get it at our website. If you want to send us an email for more details, we can also give you the contact information you'll need in order to be able to attend for yourselves. But it's time, I think, to say goodbye. Otherwise, we'll still be running by the time next week's program comes on.
Exactly. Okay. Bye-bye.
So, same time, same place next week, listeners.
Yeah.